Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. And before we meet our panel, we'll have a look at the front pages. Across the papers, there is a conversation that was going on during the week in disparate ways, crystallising today. And I think broadly it could be described as that the centre and the centre parties, which are the government parties in this country, are feeling the need to justify their existence and justify that, you know, we traditionally maybe have thought of the centre as, well, at least they get things done. And that possibly in the wake of Catherine Connolly and with other kind of environmental factors around, that they are very much trying to show we are competent and we do things. And that, of course, at the moment means housing primarily and infrastructure, kind of both as a function of housing and in general. So the Sunday Times: state fund will rival first-time home buyers. So we'll be seeing a housing plan next week, it looks like, a new housing plan. Jennifer Bray is writing here, the government will be competing with first-time buyers to purchase second-hand homes under a new 100 million plan to house those in long-term homelessness. Now, 100 million seems like a lot of money, but what are you going to buy, like 200-300 houses with it? The aim of the plan in general, to move towards a position where homelessness for individuals and families is rare, brief and non-recurring. And then, of course, as usual, kind of there's a lot of action man talk at the moment. One element will see project decision makers empowered to take more risks. They also have an off-lead there by John Mooney. Garda detectives are investigating a circle of extremists suspected of performing a small but highly dangerous far-right terrorist group called the Irish Defence Army. The IDA, which was allegedly set up to plot attacks on mosques and migrant accommodation centres on both sides of the border. So the word terrorism is now being used in this space. The Sunday Independent have more on what we might see in new housing measures. Objectors will foot far bigger bills for judicial reviews. Conal Thomas and Wayne O'Connor writing, objectors will have to foot six-figure legal bills for successful judicial review cases in a new move being brought to Cabinet to speed up the supply of infrastructure and housing. And they point out that last week in the Sunday Independent, Transport Minister Dara O'Brien accused lawyers of making a lot of money by taking judicial reviews and turning it into a, quote, cottage industry. The Business Post have a different story. The headline is "Unacceptable," in quotes, "Bank of Ireland probes staff tracker scandal slurs." So Donal McNamee writing here, I'll read the first bit of it for you because it'll give you a picture of the story. Bank of Ireland has launched a formal investigation into completely unacceptable comments made by bank officials about the tracker mortgage scandal, which affected tens of thousands of innocent homeowners over more than a decade. Internal bank records obtained by the Business Post reveal officials at Bank of Ireland last week posted disparaging messages in an official company chat, which the lender described as utterly inappropriate. In the messages, an official mocked a documentary about the tracker scandal aired on RTE on Monday. Officials also derided Padraig Cassan, the financial advisor who helped expose the matter. The Irish Mail on Sunday: Martin was warned Jim Gavin was a media dud. Now, that's based on one unnamed witness, apparently, to the Fianna Fáil review. The Mirror is leading with who Trumped. That's the 1.4 million Donald Trump style security pavilion at the Department of Agriculture. We're warned it may have to be abandoned because of a foul stench from pipes underneath it. And you would be glad to hear that that matter has been resolved now. And the Sun on Sunday is leading with how DJ Carey is getting on in jail. OK, our panel this morning: Louise Bayliss is Head of Social Justice and Policy at St Vincent de Paul. Dr Amanda Sondi is Head of Department and Senior Lecturer in Contemporary Islam at UCC. Ellen Coyne is a political correspondent with the Irish Times. And Sarah Carey is a columnist with the Irish Independent. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So Ellen, to the front pages of the Sunday Times and the Sunday Independent, they're all action on housing.
Yes, so this is ahead of the government's delayed Housing for All plan being unveiled this week. We had originally expected this in July, but the government told us they had to delay it and wait for the launch of the National Development Plan. It's not an understatement to say that this is probably the most important determining and pivotal measure in the programme for government. Some of the details are included in the Sunday Times and in the Sunday Independent. As you mentioned, this €100 million fund for second-hand homes. It seems that there is a massive political focus on that because of anxiety about the over 5,000 children in homelessness, which make up over 30% of the 16,000 people in homelessness per September 2025 figures.
And the government. I woke up this morning to a text from a young house hunter who's absolutely livid, saying this is more of it. Like, I'm trying to buy a house and now they're going to barrel in with government money and start bidding against me, and that they don't have the same restrictions that I have.
Exactly. And I think that that's what the Sunday Times has led off on. Jennifer Bray has rightly identified that this is a fund for second-hand homes, a market that is absolutely saturated and people know it's already ruthlessly competitive. But it seems that the anxiety is coming from the fact that if people have large amounts of children, they end up stuck in homelessness for longer because it's harder to find those larger homes that can accommodate them. And a particular focus as well on accommodation for single families. 75% of households in homelessness are single families. So there's a focus on that. In parallel to that, you have this housing activation office that has been working with local authorities in the background, the Accelerating Infrastructure Task Force, that's the Sean O'Driscoll Task Force.
And we'll be hearing from them soon, am I right?
The end of November or December. And separately as well, the Sunday Independent splash about capping the legal fees available for people who take judicial reviews, a massive thorn in the side for the government, who actually are having their own apartment plans subject to a judicial review at the moment. So all of these things are happening.
But I think that, just to explain that judicial review thing, at the moment, there's a kind of a sense that anyone can take one and that they have no skin in the game because they've nothing to lose by taking it, because it won't cost them money at the moment. Yes, it's paid for.
It's been one of the big talking points from the government since it formed earlier this year, that it's too easy for people to take judicial reviews. The Sunday Independent is saying that the average costs for those cases could be around 180,000 in the High Court, that most of that would be given back to people covered by the state if their case was successful. But now they want to cap it, so you'd only get around €33,250 to just try to deter people. But all of this, I think, is indicative of the fact that there's a massive anxiety, particularly in Fianna Fáil, with some of the, if you want to call it a mini heave against the Taoiseach, that delivery on infrastructure is nowhere close to where it should be, and that the patience of the public is massively running out. And if they don't deliver on this, people won't give them another chance.
Sarah Carey, it feels like we have been here before. I've been here on other Sunday mornings when the front of the pages are all about action and we're going to do this, that and the other. And, you know, is this another false dawn, or does this look like they might finally be grasping the nettle in a more productive way?
I sincerely hope it's not, because when the government was formed, there was a sense then, right, we got to do something about infrastructure. So these units were formed and the idea was, and I firmly believe this is the case, that leadership has to come from the Taoiseach and from Jack Chambers, because he's public expenditure. And it's about kind of knocking heads together and getting people in the energy world, water, planning, all together, because what's needed are decisions, decisions, decisions. So judicial
And
reviews,
do you get a sense from all of this that this is happening, this kicking down doors and you know, breaking the silos and all that kind of thing?
I hope so. I chair conferences as one of my revenue streams. There's a lot of talk in the papers today.
Is there any client you would like to recuse or mention?
No, the reason I'm mentioning that is what I have been a party to, and the reason I mentioned that was that I've chaired conferences in this whole area. So the Irish Planning Institute, for example, Guaranteed Irish had a construction forum there a couple of months ago. Property Industry Ireland, which is the IBEC kind of forum for all of this. And the reason I'm mentioning that is you get everybody in the room. You get the builders, the infrastructure people, the officials, they're all there. And there genuinely is a sense of momentum. And they really, really do want to solve these problems. And what they're all saying is.
And you're not saying that because they paid you to be there.
Well, because it's
just
umbrella.
In the current climate.
It's,
no,
it's
let's.
It's across the entire industry. Okay. And the reason I'm saying it is that it's not just a political knee-jerk reaction. This sense of momentum and need to do something is across the entire industry from every single level. Okay. And so there's a lot. So, so Shane Coleman, for example, is talking about it in the Sunday Business Post. Lucinda Creighton is making a very good point also in the Sunday Business Post today, because when they're talking about judicial
fix our infrastructure or watch the economy die.
Yeah, and she is saying we've just spent, the government just spent 5 years fully designing and eventually enacting Ireland's largest ever piece of legislation, the form of the Planning and Development Act 2024. This act was supposed to streamline and expedite the planning process. It's this huge piece of legislation. At the time it was going through, people said, but you're just going to create more judicial reviews because every line of this legislation has to be tested. And you're wondering.
And now we're already
and
working
now you're
on
already
sticking plasters,
about
are
more
we?
Legislation. Yeah. So I'm kind of annoyed about that. If they knew about these problems when they were putting through the Planning Legislation Act of 2024, why didn't they fix them then? But I do think there is a sense of momentum, but they do need to make decisions. If they don't fix this, there's going to be a lot
yeah,
of very angry
I think, Louise, some people will think that more kind of committees, more appointments, more people to knock the heads together of the people who are already there, more regulation, even if it is to cut through the existing regulation. Like that phrase, that homelessness would be rare, brief and non-recurring, would be the dream. Do you get a sense today that we might actually be seriously now?
I would hope so. I would hope so. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the new strategy, the new housing strategy that's due out this Thursday. But I would point out that the Housing for All strategy that was announced in September 2nd, it had absolutely no measures in it for family homelessness. If you remember back in 2021, and I know we all hate remembering, it was during the height of COVID and there was emergency measures in place to deal with family homelessness. And we saw the plummeting of family homelessness, which was really positive. It was great to see. And then obviously the eviction ban lifted, emergency Airbnbs came back into stock. All of that happened in family homelessness. I think there's twice it's mentioned in the whole big document about it. And basically all it says about family homelessness is it's great that it's ending and it's fabulous and basically we don't need to do anything. And in that time, we've seen family homelessness really grow so much. And currently,
now, Ellen points out they are going to specifically look for four bedroom houses,
which is brilliant. I mean, at the moment, in last March, we had 449 families with children living in emergency accommodation for two or more years. That's childhood robbed. There's 7,238 people living in families in emergency accommodation. We've more people in family homelessness than we have single adult homelessness. And we don't acknowledge that. Our crisis is a family homelessness crisis that's not there. And can I just say, this week, I was really fortunate enough to facilitate a discussion, which was a 2-year research project with families who were in emergency accommodation, lone parents who've been in emergency accommodation, and stakeholders, including members from the Department of Housing, members from HAP, Anna Visser from Child and Poverty Wellbeing Unit, and where lone parents living in emergency accommodation got to produce and to present in front of stakeholders of
to
what
tell
they
them their stories.
Yeah, to tell them their stories and also what they their solutions, which was as good as the solutions. And I have to say, it was brilliant to see stakeholders
any
listening.
Any standout solution that
yeah, there
heard?
Was one. One of the biggest one, I think, was they said we wanted a support pack when we arrived in emergency accommodation. We're traumatised, we're overwhelmed. And the overwhelming response from stakeholders was, do we not do that?
Okay.
You know,
so
there was
one
an assumption.
Little simple thing
one
that
simple
might
thing they said would make a massive difference.
Different.
Yeah.
Okay. Amanda, the piece you picked is the Sunday Independent, Conal Thomas and Wayne O'Connor, that thing about the judicial reviews. Your general views on this?
I think it's just, I mean, I speak to students every day and they tell me that they are really concerned about the fact that they might never own a home. And I find that really quite heartbreaking. I'm one of the few privileged immigrants from Scotland who was able to buy a house in Cork. And I sometimes feel, gosh, there's so many people who want this dream and they can't do it. And why is it that we're in this crisis?
What's the feeling you get of those kids? Like, is it complete hopelessness about the idea of
getting
what our generation, maybe my generation, took for granted, that someday you would have your own home?
I think there is to an extent. And the amount of students that tell me that, you know, they want to leave the country because they might possibly be able to have better housing or a better place to live, or, you know, a better life outside of Ireland. And that's really quite worrying for me as someone who's come in, and I see, you know, many of my students have left, have gone to Australia, and they tell me about these great houses that they have by the beach, etc. I mean,
I think rent's slightly cheaper in Australia. Yeah. To buy a house is way dearer in Australia than it even is in
Ireland. The dream of having a house, I think everybody should be able to have that. And it's really quite worrying.
It's quite a visceral
that we're in
thing,
this
yeah.
situation.
Sarah, you want to come back?
Yeah,
in
one
there.
Little interesting angle. I was talking about, you know, the Taoiseach knocking heads together to try and get some traction on this. Ono O'Malley's piece in the Sunday Independent is talking about how being Taoiseach isn't what it used to be. And, you know, people are looking back to Charlie Haughey in 1987 when he came in and, like, was absolutely ruthless and dedicated about getting the finances, the national finances back on track. But Owen is making the point that government has changed so much now that between coalition and what he calls layers of a self-serving bureaucracy whose interests are expanding their own power, not delivery for the common good, actually limits what ministers and the Taoiseach can do in delivering all of this. There's a lot of regulation.
It's a lot of people make the point that the country is being run by lawyers as against
politicians. That Planning Act that I mentioned in Lucinda's piece, I mean, that was given over to the charge of Paul Gallagher, the then Attorney General, and was written by a team of barristers. So, you know,
yeah, but I suppose, lawyers do have to write the law.
Yeah,
and of course, incidentally, was it Ono O'Malley's, his grandfather, Don O'Malley?
Granduncle,
Don O'Malley, who basically announced free education without telling any of his officials or telling anyone else in government.
And
he announced it
now.
And he did it.
Yeah, and just going back to the point about the fund to buy the family houses, you know, that Louise was making, and you see, and you raised it at the start, and this is the point that Lurkin Sir has been making, that ordinary buyers are now competing with the government, who are coming in buying houses that being built by the private sector, when what they should be doing is building more public housing. But again, that gets tied up in procurement and the cost of it and converting brownfield sites, you know, industrial sites. So we've got the Land Development Agency that's doing amazing work building public housing, but the cost of it is phenomenal.
But I think in this case, it's an emergency measure to deal with the 400 and odd families who are stuck there for 200 years. And as you rightly pointed out, Brendan, we're really talking about 200 or 300 houses. And for families,
that would actually make a big difference.
A massive difference.
So we're down. It's actually, we hear a big number of 16,000, but you say there are 400 or 500.
There are 400 or 500
families
for over 2 years.
That could be unblocked.
Yeah, there's about 2,300 families overall in emergency accommodation.
Okay.
But if you're thinking
not all chronically stuck.
Not all of them have been there for that long.
Ellen, can we move on to the Fianna Fáil? Issue is not going away for them, and if they can't finish their review, so it stays alive. You picked John Lee's piece in the Mail on Sunday today. This front page: Martin was warned Jim Gavin was a media dud. Now, it's fairly tenuous, I would have thought, to take a headline out of it, and that it's one unnamed person saying, well, we knew he was no good at media performances. They do say the decision to have him was made much longer before we thought it was made. I'm not phrasing that very well, but the decision was made earlier than we think.
Yeah, so as you say, this is basically one person's contribution to the review, and everybody in Fianna Fáil was kind of invited to contribute to this report that we had expected on Wednesday, but it seems there's a bit of expectation management about that now, partly being blamed on the Taoiseach being in Brazil, partly being blamed on the PP needing a little bit more time to work on it. But I think the reason that it's probably relevant is I would imagine that sentiment is probably held by a lot of people in Fianna Fáil, that a lot of us could have anticipated what this review might say, which is that, you know, the Taoiseach himself had said that he had been having conversations with Jim Gavin over the summer. I think at one point he had been specific that he had been talking to him in July. And the sense that the parliamentary party has is that Micheál Martin decided then that he was going to be
and
the candidate.
Are the forensics of this, Ellen, going to make a if there's forensics in that report, are they going to make a difference to Micheál Martin? Could something in there trip him up? Or some people seem to think he's kind of out the gap now with each day that goes on and his time is shortened, but he's not going anywhere for now.
I think it would prove politically fatal, actually, if the review is too ambivalent or complimentary, because there is a suspicion, some might say a paranoia, growing within these rebels that were on the controversial list, that this report is going to be a whitewash.
Just tell people about that list. Willie O'Dea is around. They're really indignant about that list, aren't they?
I'm a little bit bewildered by the outrage about it. So basically, there was this list was being circulated around Leinster House of a list of people who were the so-called rebels and three members of the old guard. So Willie O'Dea, Seanan Fáil and Pat the Cope Gallagher. And basically, it was a list of the people who have been critical of Micheál Martin's views. But it's being written as if it's kind of like, you know, these secret papers from within the Fianna Fáil machinery. It's a list that anyone who's paid attention to the news over the past month could write themselves, because half the people on it have been on the record being critical.
I asked a politician, a Fianna Fáil guy, about it during the week, and he said everyone knows the first rule is you never write down a list.
But I still don't understand what's so controversial. Like, I could have written that list
myself. Willie O'Dea is not happy about being called an old guard, is it?
I think the whole thing is a bit of a joke. So in The Sun, Gary Manili has an article, Party Fury Over Prez Probe Delay. They don't need an inquiry. Jim Gavin and Billy Kelleher were voted on in a parliamentary party meeting. 41, including Micheál Martin, obviously voted for Jim Gavin. And any one of them could have looked at Jim Gavin and said, he's going to be crap on television. He's no political history.
I know, but the argument would be that a lot of those guys were in a hostage situation because they had to support the leader.
They could easily have used their own judgment and voted for Billy. And I think it was a secret ballot, wasn't it? So yeah. Micheál Martin wouldn't have even known. And I was talking to Fianna Fáil.
Someone would have written a list.
I was talking to Fianna Fáil before that meeting, and I said to a few of them, Billy is likable and Jim Gavin is an unknown quantity, and we know what happens to celebrities when they go into the presidential thing. So I think they need an inquiry into their own sense of judgment. They had Billy there and they didn't vote for him, so they should cut themselves on now.
Do you blame them or do you blame Micheál Martin?
I don't know. I watched some of the theatrics and the conversation, and I'm just like, there was, you know, you want somebody who is able to articulate at least what they're going to say, and this kind of bumbling mess is not really helpful for, you know, people who are going to vote you in, especially when you have I mean, how are you trying to identify with those individuals? And I think some people came out more smooth. We want kind of, I mean, dare I say it, straight talking, being able to, I mean, surely politicians should be able to have some media savvy to be able to, but then he wasn't a politician, or he was a politician. I don't know. I'm so confused by this guy.
No, he wasn't a politician. And this was one of the things that allegedly made him look so good on paper. But look, that man has suffered enough. Let us not judge on him again today. Maybe we move on then, Louise, to broader kind of coalition tensions that are being written about today. Daniel Murray in the Business Post, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael not getting on. The row is existential, they're saying.
Yeah, it's interesting to see what he talks about. And I suppose we all noticed it back when we saw how closely they worked together in the last coalition government. Then in November, we watched the panels, the political panels, where they started sniping at each other. You know, people who had been on the same tide. We saw Hildegard Nocton against Jack Chambers. All of that spite. Then they came together, merged together beautifully again.
Yeah, Pat Rabbit would say, isn't that just...
It's just what you do before elections, obviously. But then you see them all merging together again. But there's definitely been things. I think the whole thing around Ivan Yates and teaching Jim Gavin, and because Fine Gael got the slack, you know, they got the heat for saying, isn't that what you do, smear the bejesus out of her before the election. They got vilified for that comment that Ivan Yates, because he was a former Fine Gael minister, obviously he was linked to that. And then meanwhile, Fianna Fáil did keep quiet about the fact that they had hired Ivan Yates to do the training with Jim Gavin. So I think there is that tension going, why did they not support it? There was also that tension that when it was down to two candidates, that Fianna Fáil did not really get behind the Fine Gael candidate. They just backed out of the coalition.
And that they should have done the right thing for the centre to hold.
Yeah, there was this also thought that if it had been the other way around, if their candidate, Heather Humphreys, had gone out and there was only Jim Gavin, that they would have rode behind it. Whether that would have happened or not is another guess.
Is so silly from Fine Gael. Fianna Fáil used to have this really lofty idea that it was Fianna Fáil's job to kind of look after the country and look after everyone. And I wonder, are Fine Gael actually subscribing to that idea now? Mm. That it's Fianna Fáil's job to solve all their problems. First of all, they were expected to come out and admit when Ivan Yates was in the centre of a media storm that they had paid this guy for communications advice when they were already dealing with the combustion of their own presidential election. And then this stuff about how it was Fianna Fáil's job to help Heather Humphreys win the presidential election. Why can't Fianna Gael hold its own in a one-on-one contest between
But if they weren't holding their own, was he not the lesser of two evils for Fianna Fáil in some way?
The Taoiseach came out and said he was endorsing Heather Humphreys.
He said he'd vote for her.
But that's an endorsement. Like, Bertie Ahern came out, there was loads of people in the Fianna Fáil PP.
I think
a lot of
people voted for Heather Humphreys, weren't endorsing her.
Well, I mean, like, Micheál Martin gave a speech where he basically made a veiled criticism of Catherine Connolly when he was talking about people who aren't supportive of the EU.
Like, okay, so you think he did his bit?
They are a competitive political
party. Between the lines.
I thought it was a bit weird.
You are Fine Gael gene pool, we should just say.
It's all about, everything has to be declared now. So yeah, I have all.
If you're reared with blue shirt blood, like, that is an important dog in this race of this conversation.
Well, I fully endorsed Heather Humphreys in my column publicly in the Irish Independent. And I did think that Micheál was a bit, I don't know, it was just a bit weak. Oh, I'm voting for her, but I'm not asking anybody else to vote for her.
But they couldn't. You know, how, after the Jim Gavin thing, could Micheál Martin tell anyone how to vote?
Because that's what leadership is. Leadership is doing the brave thing.
But they're Fianna Fáil, they're not Fine Gael.
Exactly. So what happened to the national interest? If you actually believed that Catherine Connolly would not be a good president, then the right thing to do would be to rise above the party, not go on the political, you know, your immediate political identity, and do the right thing.
Can I just say, Sarah, one of the reasons there was only two candidates was because Simon Harris stepped in and told councillors that they could not vote for independent candidates going around the local authority. That was, in one sense, you could say that's thwarting the political system. Mm. The political system was designed that we would have mainstream parties being able to nominate their candidates with the 20 candidates from the legislation, and that independence would have a fair route by going through councils. And that would give it, that it wasn't just open for anybody, but that elected representatives got to vote for a nomination. Simon Harris, and now I'm not saying Micheál Martin probably didn't do similar, but Simon Harris openly told his councillors that they weren't allowed to. That closed off a route.
We're not going to refight this war.
I think the current
manifestation of all of that there is that Ivan Yates, there's still a lot about him in the papers today. So, Sarah, you picked Shane Ross's piece. Yates has put role as political pundit and lobbyist at risk.
Yeah, and like you were saying...
Can I ask you first, do you do media training for people?
No, I don't do any work for any political party or anything like that.
Nothing. You chair events and stuff.
They're mostly for umbrella industrial organisations.
We're going to be eating up a lot of time in general.
I know, everyone's going to have to call out our list.
So go on.
So Shane Ross does have a good line where he says, Ivan is to politics what Eamon Dunphy was to sport. You know, and the idea, of course, is, you know, there's a lot of braggadocio, you know, and a lot of... you know, catchy phrases and getting a lot of history. And at the end of the day...
And it was all good fun until it wasn't.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, we probably should get a bit of a grip. Like, he's a podcast host. Do you know? Like, it's not public service broadcasting
He was presenting on a commercial station, News Talk, and he was...
So here's
on
my
RT
take.
Commentating, but outside of the period under regulation.
So my take on Ivan is, and I don't know the man, is he's a grafter, he's a worker. Like, I didn't listen to that Path to Power podcast too much, but when I did, it was to get all those constituency profiles that he does. I know he's done the work for Fianna Fáil, but I don't think anyone can ever accuse him of pulling his punches. Like, he's, you know, tears strips off absolutely everybody. but he absolutely should. And I don't understand when you look how at he didn't
some, when
say
you look
about
at
Jim
some
Gavin.
Of the stuff, yeah, he, I mean, when yeah. you look at some of the stuff also, he was clearly saying stuff about Jim Gavin as if he was saying it kind of casually.
There's
but
no
that stuff
question
that was informed by him being.
He should have
in
declared
close proximity.
It because, particularly in the presidential election, when it's all about the debate and there were so few candidates, like it. Beggars belief that he didn't say it. And some people are saying, oh, Matt's overplaying this. But I completely understand why Matt was angry. And I think he reacted in the only way he could have. Now, the problem is that because of Ivan Yates, and Killian Woods has an article here in the Sunday Business Post where he's saying there are other people who do this as well. So, you know, Anton Savage would do work like this. He mentions
OK,
Mandy
yeah. Now,
as well.
We don't know that Anton yeah. Savage has ever not disclosed any training he's done or
yes,
anything. So
yeah.
let's not drag other people's names into
so,
this casually. Like.
So, look, I think...
But
it
he
is,
does do media training and he is a presenter.
I think Ivan probably will recover from it because he does put in the work. He is admired by an awful lot of people. But... it's definitely made life difficult for an awful lot of people, and it would have been so easy to solve. All he had to do was say, "I trained Jim Gavin."
I noticed,
yeah, and
that
also on Anton, we don't know that Anton still does media training himself either. Go on, Emma.
Sorry, I noticed there's so much in the papers about journalists. You all write about each other, and it's really quite interesting just to hear about it. And the great music.
Is there anything more fascinating?
It's fantastic because you fill the papers and how you're all going through these musical chairs of how you're moving from one station to the other. I just find that quite fascinating.
Yeah, there's
outsider,
loads about
it's
RTE.
Great. But
yeah.
you know what I find really interesting
you
is
see, journalism is having an existential crisis, so it's kind
but
of a bit self-obsessed at the moment. Always, do you think, Ellen? Yeah.
I'm assuming the job of a journalist is to get you know, the debate, the conversation going. And so that, in a sense, is happening. But now, you know, there's the party political allegiances, which we have to kind of think about.
I think it's
well.
Slightly different, though, because there has been the rise, you know, journalism is... I'm going to say it, an honourable profession. There are guidelines around it, you know, verifying your sources, all of that. And there's been this
rise... And
it's
the only thing that separates them from the animals at this stage, like in terms of the online world.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Journalism is trying to justify itself
yeah, no,
by saying
and
we are not like that.
There is this thing, there's verifying your sources to make sure all that. And there is this, the rise of the celebrity person. And Ivan Yates was a celebrity person. He wasn't a journalist. And I think that was lost somewhere along the way that he wasn't trained
okay,
like
so
a journalist.
You actually picked Alison O'Connor's piece. I'll come to you in a second on this, Ellen, but Ivan Yates is down, but I doubt he's out. Yeah?
Yeah, because I think for different reasons probably than Sarah, but I do think he is a celebrity. He's not a journalist and he was put into roles that possibly he should not have been doing it. He loves to get, you know, to get the rise out of people. He's controversial. He doesn't mince his words. He's not worried about whether his sources are not. He threw things out there that others hadn't. There is a purpose for him, but do not confuse him with a trained journalist. I think that's... And I was on a show one time with him on News Talk and it was a piece about children being taken out of school to go on holidays. And I kind of had to put up my hand and go, I've done it, you know, for the cost of cheaper holidays in June. I've taken Sophia out of school for that week in June and got my half price holiday. And so I admitted, I said, I understand why parents do it. And he, just before we went on air, he said, Louise, can we have a bit of fun with this? Mm. And he winked at me. And then he went through me like a shortcut, you know, teachers have enough. And so I was water off a duck's back because, you know, he kind of let me know he's going to go through me. But when I came off air, he was very polite and very, that was great fun. Thanks very much. And walked out, you know, and that was it.
Yeah.
And my friends were phoning me going, are you OK? Are you upset? And I was like, I know. He was just having the rise.
An entertainer, yeah.
Yeah.
OK, Ellen, I'll give you the last word on this.
He is an entertainer and I think he probably will be back as Alison predicted. Like there is mutiny in the Path to Power comments at the moment on the podcast because people want entertainment from Ivan Yates, not, you know, the kind of information that they might get from journalists. I think there is a potential to jump the shark here a little bit, like watching Holly Cairns being quizzed on The Late Late Show about if she'd ever had media training. There's a difference between media training and spin. Media training tells someone how to present
They've
information.
They've all had media training, have they?
Of course, and some of them could do with a little bit more. Some of them could probably do...
Gail have media training too, a lot of them, yes?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the SIPO returns, you can see that there's is tens of thousands spent by every party. I think that this shouldn't, I mean, the expectation that Fianna Fáil, this should have been something that Fianna Fáil disclosed, I don't really think is a credible political argument. It probably is one for broadcasters to be conscious of if they have someone on who isn't declaring an interest that is relevant. But I think that media training in and of itself has always been a very innocuous part of Irish politics.
And sure, it has to be. They need it if you're going to be on air skill, doing interviews. You need to be good at it. You need to be trained.
When you're against journalists and broadcasters, a lot of whom are going to try and savage you, you need to have some tools at your hands. Yeah. Okay, we'll take a break. Louise Bayliss, Dr. Amanda Sondi, Ellen Coyne and Sarah Carey staying with us. Welcome back. Our excellent panel still here. Louise Bayliss, Dr. Amanda Sondi, Ellen Coyne and Sarah Carey. Aman, you were looking at Gary Murphy today in the Sunday Times, a really nice piece, Open Debate Can Stop the Far Right Rising.
So this is actually a really lovely piece. It's Gary Murphy writes about going to the Nursing Homes Ireland Care Awards. So it's basically a representation body of private and voluntary nursing home sector that kind of, I think, is an umbrella of more than 27,000 people across the state. And it was kind of on the back of an RTE investigation about some of the issues going on in care homes.
Yeah.
So this was
what he saw there.
Yeah, yeah. And what he saw there was, I think the Minister of State for Older People was also in attendance, but it was the awards were given to these great people. And what kind of emerged was the winners came from Spain, India, and I think the overall winner was from the Philippines. And the article is very interesting because, you know, Gary's kind of talking about how, you know, a debate about this, who is kind of doing the work, who's kind of looking after each other. And it kind of, you know, does get us to think about immigration in a different way.
Yeah. OK. So how did you feel about, so you are Scottish, you're of Pakistani descent. How did you feel about the way the debate around immigration was opened up in the last week or two, say the comments made by Simon Harris that we have too much immigration. Now, he wasn't, he did clarify afterwards, he was talking about across the board. He was talking about those workers that were there that night as well.
Yeah, I mean, this has become such a big hot potato issue now. You know, everybody's talking about immigration and what immigrants are doing, you know, and they're coming in. And there's many layers to this as well. Like, you know, the Islamophobia is on the rise. I'm a Muslim myself. And it's the different layers of my identity.
How do you experience Islamophobia? Is it subtle?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to kind of pinpoint it. Like, you know, the other week I was asked to comment on BBC Radio Scotland about Glasgow Central Mosque had painted on its wall Scots first. And that was like, you know, what's happening. And I've never seen that. You know, I grew up in a Scotland where we grew up with the phrase, we're all Jock Tamson's bairns. You know, we're all in this together.
Yeah. Class in Scotland was the big delineator. Yeah.
But I do worry. I don't think that debate has happened properly in Ireland. I think there is still this idea that there is something white about Irishness. I know that, and that's completely not logical or rational, but it is in the psyche of people that to be Irish is to be white. And I think what this does to a minority of people, you know, living their lives is quite worrying. I have the privilege, you know, I open my mouth and people kind of hear this Scottish accent and get really excited about it. I worry about people who don't have fluency of language. I worry about people who are for all sorts of different reasons in different parts of the system, you know, to getting their, you know, Irish citizenship, etc. So it's quite complicated, but I think things are...
This is interesting now, and I don't want to cross any lines here, but are you a more, quotes, acceptable form of an immigrant to this country than you would be if you didn't have a Scottish accent and people just saw the colour of your skin?
I think there is a debate about who makes a good immigrant and who's a bad immigrant. And I think that is quite worrying
as well. And is it about racism? Is it about race and skin colour, or where are people drawing the lines, do you think?
I think the way we discriminate is so superficial. We discriminate on so what your immediate perception is of that person looking at them, what's coming out of their mouth, and that really scares me. You know, that like my dad came to the UK in the 50s, my mum came in the 60s, and some of the stories that my dad would tell were just kind of harrowing. You know, about, you know, he used to work in the buses, he did very menial jobs, he had a high school education. My mother is illiterate. She looks at the letters that fall through the postbox and she knows what's in it. She can't read it. And I just find that, you know, just really it's shaped who I am. But I think everybody's experience is different. But what, you know,
okay, what, back would, to what Ireland, would a good open conversation look like that took this conversation away from the extremes you?
We've talked about party politics. We've talked about the Irish presidential election. How many of our candidates for the presidency or within the political parties are actually talking about black or brown people in this country? Apart from this huge crisis that we're having in immigrants, you know, our hospitals, our university, I'm teaching in a university. Many of our teachers, many of our individuals, we've got these, you know, in the nursing home, you know, people who are caring for our older white individuals, let's say it.
I think that is acknowledged, but almost as a kind of a both sidesing of things. People go, and of course they say in a very worthy way, of course we know that they are great for looking after our old people as
yes,
well.
Yes, but I'm still not convinced that the debate has got to the stage where we have a broad tent idea of what Irishness is.
Yeah.
And I think once we start to do that, that's where we're going to see a shift. And I think we're beginning to see that shift in Irish politics. I think the lines are getting much more hardened
to see more people in politics as well?
Well, I mean, you don't want to be tokenistic. You don't just want to have black and brown people. You want to see them trained. You want to see the best people getting it. But let's not forget that we have unconscious biases as well. Like I said, you know, the way we perceive people, the way we look at people. So it's very complicated. But I think this is a good start. I think what Gary's saying is, let's have a conversation about that, because we're very quick to stuff people into boxes. But once we sit with them, once we begin to complicate our minds, complicate our living, and we love our comfort zones. We love to stay in our comfort zones. But I think we need to move out of that a little bit. And I think it is happening. I'm an optimist. I think it is happening in the Irish landscape. When I came here in 2015, I thought, my goodness, what have I walked into? Because I came from Miami. And now I see there is discussion about multiculturalism. There is discussion about multi-faith schools. I think the Archbishop was talking about a survey that's happening about whether our schools should have religion or be multi-denominational. So there's lots of debate happening. So I think we are in a positive direction.
That's brilliant, isn't it, Sarah?
It really is.
I learned more there in about 4 minutes than I've learned in the last month.
It feeds into something that I've been writing about a lot recently, which is this sudden focus on the Irish language. And I think the sense of Irishness and nationalism is actually deepening and becoming very toxic in recent times.
But is it toxic? Is it okay for a generation to connect with their roots and their dukes? And it, like, you know, people will say that does not mean that they are saying we are more Irish than you.
Look how people are being shamed for not speaking Irish.
Are they being shamed?
Heather Humphreys was shamed during the presidential campaign because she didn't speak Irish. It was coming through in a lot of surveys that people felt the president should speak Irish. Catherine Connolly, it's been said.
I think people
it's
floating, feeling oh, hang on, that Brendan, the president wait. Should speak Irish
yes, but
is not
now,
shaming anyone for not doing it.
But now there's a proposal to say that the working language which in the Oris will be Irish. So everybody has to speak Irish. There's the Irish Language
Act.
If it's
English, everybody has to speak English.
The Irish Language Act says that 20% of people in the public service must be able to speak Irish. That's across the entire health sector. So because that means that when you go into your nursing home and you've got your Filipino or your Indian nurse, that you have a right to exercise your constitutional right to have your healthcare delivered through Irish. This is... I think it really is discriminating against people when it comes to jobs, that there's a pile now in the public service. If you can do your job through Irish, your application goes into one pile.
I want to go back to a man on this. Do you feel that this there's been a focus on the Irish language, as we reflected yesterday. Michael D. Higgins was a great man to promote the Irish language too, so it's not a new thing. Do you feel that's narrowing and exclusivizing what you were talking about what it means to be Irish?
Well, I mean, I understand the pride and joy of the Irish language. And, you know, I wish I would actually love to learn, but I'm a little bit now worried in case I say I'm going to learn it and then I don't, because, you know, people get done for doing that. But so I think there's something about language which is mixed with culture. When I grew up, my mother told us, you can speak whatever you want outside, but you need to speak Punjabi at home. And we kind of grumbled at this. And now I understand the benefit of being able to speak Punjabi at home. And outside in the streets of Glasgow, we were between Glasgow Celtic, Glasgow Rangers, and we were speaking also, whether it's English or not, it's debatable, but I'm just joking. You know, so there's a discussion about that. But language is so mixed with the culture. So I understand the pride. And I think it's important to have that discussion in Ireland. And it would be great if we were all given the opportunity to learn language.
Ellen, they say politics is downstream of culture. Like, so is this cultural movement going to get, is it getting more political?
I mean, I would take a very different view from Sarah, because obviously when she's talking about promotion of the Irish language, that's specifically the Catherine Connolly campaign. And I think you could actually look at the Catherine Connolly campaign in a different way. When some people would say abusing and misusing Irish pride and identity and the way that the tricolour has been used, maybe it's refreshing that you have a left-wing campaign that is very positive on immigration, that uses Irish culture in that way. Like, if you look at the typography of the Connolly campaign, it was kind of this traditional Irish font. I actually, just from covering the Connolly campaign, felt like my Irish got better and downloaded Duolingo in the middle of the campaign.
What about healthcare? Like, what about people's jobs in healthcare and foreign people working in the healthcare system?
I mean, it is the national language.
Louise, what do you think?
I think I've myself to have discovered a renewed love for the Irish language, and just even things like reading books about the use of words. We have the descriptive use of word. I was reading something yesterday and it was talking about, we have no Irish word for please, and as you know, it would be leadahull.
Moshedahull.
No, leadahull. Leadahull is,
if it is your will.
Yeah, exactly. And it's about that step deeper than not just please, it's if it's with your will. And that, you know, the deepness and richness of the language. So I think that's to be embraced. But again, nobody should be discriminated from not having it. And I do think, you know, one of the things that really struck me when Sophia was in primary school, young kids, her school was very multicultural, but a lot of the parents didn't realise Irish was a compulsory language. And I met the parents, and that it was an examinable subject. So I met the parents outside the school and they'd say, oh, isn't it lovely they do a bit of Irish? And I was like, no, it's not a bit of Irish. This is an exam subject. They won't go forward. Just, you know, and that knowing that they need to know that, you know, if you are coming in as a migrant, that you may not realise Irish is an exam subject.
But you may not have to do it either.
Brendan, just a little plug for a voluntary group I'm a member of, Fáilte Isteach. It's a nationwide movement set up in Summerhill 20 years ago by Mary Nally and originally funded by Dennis O'Brien. And we teach English to migrants. And they can be people who are 20 years, they can be people in the IPAS system. And if there is anybody who, you know, is bored or is lonely or wants to get to know people in their area, look up Fáilte Isteach. Okay. And you don't have to be a teacher.
And Sarah, I can tell you won't be making them speak Irish.
Do you know what? We do a class where we put up Irish names to teach them how to pronounce Irish names, and their heads melt.
Okay.
It's the hardest class of the year.
Just quickly,
I think it's interesting, but Ireland's newest immigrant is Cara Owen, who is the new British ambassador to Ireland, and I was at her welcome reception just the other day, and she's learning Irish. She has an Irish teacher, and she kept referring, and I think the Irish teacher was actually there in the room, so this is great. So I think it's important. I'd love to learn the Irish language as well.
Okay. Well, now they've got you.
Sarah reckons we'll be making everyone learn Irish. Okay, we'll take a break. Louise Bayliss, Dr. Aman Dasandi, Ellen Coyne and Sarah Carey Sting. Okay, welcome back. My panel still with us. Louise Bayliss, Dr. Aman Dasandi, Ellen Coyne and Sarah Carey. And I would have liked to have spent more time on the rock star of the week, Ellen. It's Zoran Mamdani. That has, I think, has that kind of got people here thinking as well?
Well, I think it's actually the reverse. I think that the Mamdani campaign has some similarities to the presidential campaign, where he's made all these promises that people have voted for him without much expectation that he will deliver it, similar to the way we look like a look at a president. And I wonder, in this kind of post anti-establishment politics world, do people want a politician who feels the most about their problems rather than one who knows the most about their problems? Because it was his empathy and his directness that won the campaign.
So feel their pain. Feel their pain.
Yeah, like, I mean, these commitments to free childcare, city-owned grocery stores, free buses. A lot of people voted for him with the full expectation that that may never happen. But the fact that he has these policies that shows he feels for them on the cost of living, I think is really interesting. And the fact that actually he won the New York City mayoral contest on almost the same platform that Trump won the presidency on last year, which was the cost of living.
Yeah. Aman? Were you excited to see Zoran Mamdani, a Muslim man?
I just couldn't keep up with the layers of his identity.
Yeah.
He's Muslim, he's Ugandan. I think at some point he classified himself as black and then he's brown. He turns up at 1
a.m. He's privileged as well, though, then, on the other hand, isn't he?
His mother is, I mean, I remember watching the movies Monsoon Wedding, and I think Kama Sutra was there as well. But he, what really got me was he turned up at a gay bar, I think at 1 o'clock in the morning, in order to get, and I thought that
would
was...
Would you find a lot of Muslims in a gay bar at 1 o'clock in the morning?
Well, you probably would. And it's a shame because the idea is that, you know, that Muslims are homophobes, and, you know, here you have somebody who's presenting himself as a progressive Muslim. So I think he's really breaking out of these boxes that we like to put Muslims into. And I think it's just fascinating to look at where he came from. His dad, I think, is a really renowned anthropologist at Columbia. But, you know, he's making all these great kind of ideas that he's going to put them into place. But I think he just speaks to so many different people. So, and
it's about a coalition, isn't it? The same as Catherine Connolly a bit was. It's about, not about one group, really. It's about being able to speak to lots of different substrata and make a coalition around that. Louise, would you really quickly tell us the story that Maeve Sheehan has in the Sunday Independent today about the man who I think was, we all noted this week, who stood by DJ Carey.
Yeah, and he stood by him in a very humane way, not in a very, you're a celebrity and I'm just fawning after you. It was a lovely way he did it. He identified the flaws that were in his thing, but he said, I suffered mental health issues. I'm looking at a man who's had the most huge fall from grace, huge shame and stigma. Now, he did point out that he needs to sit there down where he is and reflect on what he's done. He pointed out things that he didn't befriend him, you know, because he thought he was right. He befriended him as a man in need and as a Christian thing to do.
Took him into his house,
fed him steak from his own farm, potatoes that were grown on his own farm, didn't give him huge sums of money, but gave him €107 for his diesel and some sweets in a petrol station. He went up to the court, drove him up using his own car and had a flask of tea and some fig rolls in the boot of the car to keep them on their way.
Like, but just also, and people will find this maybe hard to get their heads around, accepted that DJ Carey was still kind of lying to him.
He absolutely said the whole thing, kind of deluded. He said that was the one thing he kind of ended with. He said he did acknowledge that he'd an awful fall, you know, that he had brought an awful lot of misery on his own life, but didn't reflect on the misery he caused on other people's lives, and still was spinning tales around giving 200,000 to a woman in Switzerland who was undergoing treatment with no proof of it. The man didn't fall for the lies, but just accepted him where he was and hopes that he will reflect and grow as a person as a result of his imprisonment.
I started talking the show yesterday about redemption, and I think we all have to always believe in the possibility of redemption.
And that's what it was. It was
life,
a Christian
don't
act.
We? A Christian act, yeah. Sarah Carey, Jimmy Wolfe and Wayne O'Connor are writing about turkeys in the Sunday Independent today. You know a little bit about this.
Yeah, so there's a woman called Mary Breen from Cullen End. She lives on the Limerick-Tipperary border, and every year she's been rearing 45 turkeys, and this year she can't rear her turkeys anymore. And the problem is it's all to do with these cross-infection regulations to do with bird flu. So the slaughterers can't come to her farm to kill her turkeys because they might bring infection. And it's a terrible shame that this practice of rearing one's own turkeys has fallen out of practice.
So do people do? You grew up on a farm.
So
do a lot of people have a small turkey holding friends and neighbours?
It
at
used
Christmas?
To be a really big thing. So I grew up on a small farm. My mother would get maybe a dozen to 15 little turkey chicks, and we'd rear them, which was the biggest pain. Our job as kids, we were supposed to put them in at night. We'd always forget. It would be dust. They'd go up on the roof. You'd be throwing stones at them to get them down. I remember one year, one of the turkeys fell, broke his leg. We called him Hoppy. And I remember one Easter digging into the turkey, and my sister said, "Whatever happened to Hoppy?" And Mammy said, "You're eating him." And there was a bit of a pause, and we carried on. So, you know, Hoppy, okay. I hope you're okay somewhere. But it's a pity that that practice is dying out because of regulations, because they were great turkeys. And
yeah,
Mary
but we
Green,
do have to be careful.
Yeah, Mary Breen is describing, yeah. you know, the free range element of it.
And
so
the woman doesn't know where she's going to get a turkey that tastes like the turkeys that she reared
exactly.
so well. Listen, before we go, Louise, you just wanted to say something briefly about the great Sister Stan.
I do. I mean, Sister Stan was the founder of Focus Ireland, where I worked for 8 years. She was a remarkable lady. She brought such humanity to the role she did. And she embedded in values with us, you know, about talking about the importance of the customer. Whenever you met her, it was always about the voice
of the customer.
And she called them customers, and we used to challenge her, why customer? And she said when she founded the Focus, the coffee shop, she expected people to be treated like customers, not like clients, that they were paying customers, and she gave them that dignity and respect. She was just a remarkable woman, and she impacted me. And she listened to the show regularly, and then one time I came out of here and I got an email from her that day going, "You were brilliant today. Thanks for being there."
Well, do you know what? I think she would say the same today, and she would say the same about all of you. Louise Bayliss, Dr. Amanda Sondy, Ellen Coyne and Sarah Carey, thank you all very much for that excellent and lively hour. And now it's 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom.